Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RSEVS specialist in small animal orthopaedics, Kinley Smith. Thank you, Kinley. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Super. Well, thank you for listening to this webinar. And the reason I wanted to talk about this subject is I think it's something that there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think we try and give the best advice we have. But what I want to do is really go through the whole story of joint health in detail and give you the evidence that we've actually got. And then we can spend a little bit of time deciding what really we should be telling owners, from owners of very sedentary dogs right up to athletic dogs. So, as an overview of the topic, I'm going to talk a little bit about the development of joints. We'll go through husbandry and exercise and how that relates to healthy joints. We'll talk about nutrition and the importance of weight control. And then I'll just do a couple of slides on specific diseases that I think are quite important, not directly to healthy joints, but by missing them can end up with knock-on effects. So firstly, we need to discuss what a joint is. And a joint isn't one thing, it's an organ. And an organ is different tissues that work together. So we have our bone, specifically subchondral bone, and this is the supporting structure for our joint. On top of this, we have our cartilage, which reduces joint friction and acts as a shock absorber for us. We have a ligament, which maintains bone alignment, but also facilitates motion of the bones to each other. And lastly, we have our synovium, which is lubrication and also cartilage nutrition from the synovial fluid. So joint development happens really from growth of long bones and growth of the epiphysis. And really with the growth of the long bone, about 80% comes from the growth plate. So the growth plate is this sandwich of cartilage between the epiphysis and the metaphysis. And what we see is an expansion of that cartilage growth plate, and then behind that, the metaphyseal bone, the cartilage in the growth plate develops into metaphyseal bone. The epiphysis is a bit different. The epiphysis, we see radial expansion of the cartilage, and then the bone, again, through endochondral ossification, grows in and forms a subchondral bone. We also have differences in blood supply. In the juvenile dog, we have separate blood supplies to the epiphysis and to the metaphysis, but actually as you approach skeletal maturity, the epiphyseal supply merges into the metaphyseal supply, and that's important in certain conditions that we'll come to later on. So there are many factors that affect growth. We can have intrinsic factors, so gender, male, female, and the genetics. Obviously, a Great Dane is going to reach a different size from a Yorkshire Terrier. But we also have extrinsic factors as well. Nutrition, husbandry and disease can all affect the growth, both rate and absolute size of our patients. So we have, defining growth, we have the Hüther-Volkmann law, which basically says that if you want to retard growth, you increase compression, and if you want to accelerate growth, then you increase tension or reduce loading. And very many joints in the body require either compression or tension to form. So an example would be in the stifle, the trochlear sulcus requires compression of the patella to form normally, and if you've got patella luxation, then you'll have an abnormal trochlear sulcus. So that means that if we've got rapidly growing dogs, even if you've got a short or transient period of abnormality, you can actually have profound effects as you get knock-on altered loading in other joints and other parts of the dog. So when we talk about joint disease, we have to think of it as primary and secondary joint disease. So primary joint disease can affect any part of the joint. We can have trauma, we can have inflammation, infection, or degeneration. And I put degeneration in inverted commas because there is a low level of inflammation in conditions that we call degenerative, such as osteoarthritis. We can also get secondary joint disease as well. And this is abnormalities or a disease that's distant from the joint. So things like conformational abnormalities, so a dog perhaps with an angular limb deformity in the forelimb might have abnormal forces going through the elbow or the shoulder. Other musculoskeletal disease and obesity can all cause secondary joint disease. And this joint disease typically manifests as pain, which we see as lameness. Now, maintaining healthy joints requires an understanding of the factors that contribute to both primary and to secondary joint disease. And the reason this is important is because we have to be aware of the domino effect. The domino effect is that if you get an abnormality in one joint or one part of the musculoskeletal system, this can have ramifications in other parts. So the most classic effect that we see is a diagonal lameness. So if a dog is lame in its left fore, it will often appear to have a right hind lameness because it alters its gait pattern. So if, particularly in growing dogs, we want to prevent this effect, we need early diagnosis and appropriate therapy to have long-term benefits as well as the short-term benefits to solve the lameness. So just to go over osteoarthritis in a bit more detail, osteoarthritis is more an umbrella term. It's a common final pathway for the failing joint. And we see degradation of articular cartilage, but we also see disease of subchondral bone, we see disease of ligament and of synovium. So it affects all parts of the joint organ. And we get inflammation in the joint, which leads to osteophytosis, the new bone formation in which we make a radiographic diagnosis of osteoarthritis. It's common. 20% of adult dogs affected, more so in cats. We see lameness, we see joint pain, we see stiffness too, and the stiffness can arise from joint fibrosis, which reduces the range of motion, but we also see in painful joints, we see muscle tension around that joint, which again can make the dog appear stiff. We see dogs becoming less active, but we also see gait alterations, and this can exacerbate or cause orthopedic disease at other sites too. I also think, and this is only my personal opinion, that we get depression. I think dogs in chronic pain get depressed, they get fed up, so they're all good reasons why we want to keep these joints nice and healthy. So, let's have a chat about exercise. We need to think of exercise in subdivided into quantity and into quality. So, the quantity, how long is the walk? How long are they going out for? But when we talk about quality, is the walk on lead or off lead? Are these dogs just plodding along beside their owners, or are they out chasing balls, sticks, pheasants, squirrels, whatever happens to be about? Because that changes the way dogs use their legs, use their joints. We also need to consider some absolutes. No exercise, that is not doing anything at all, isn't healthy for dogs, nor is it desirable. And we want our dogs to do some exercise, but most clients want their animals to do some exercise. And let's face it, all dogs undertake at least some exercise, even if it's only moving about the house. We also get breed differences in the amount of exercise they undertake. A whippet compared to a pug, they're going to take different amounts of exercise. There's lots of reasons for this. Part is the psychology of the patient, part is the athleticism, part are other disease conditions which might influence the amount they want to walk around. But one thing I'll emphasise now is we actually have very little research in which to base our recommendations. So if we consider briefly growing dogs, let's just pause to think, what harms might we do in our growing dogs? So in theory, we could get damage to joint structures such as cartilage and ligament from overload of these developing structures. We also might get abnormal joint loading from poor coordination or undeveloped muscle. And this leads to abnormal weight bearing, abnormal development, and that can possibly cause dysplasia. But we also have to think of the benefits exercise might bring too. We might get an improvement in neuromuscular coordination, which might improve joint loading. We might control bone growth. After all, 90% of bone growth is seen in periods of rest. So if animals are very sedentary during the juvenile period, perhaps they might grow more rapidly or more overall. We might improve the development of a musculoskeletal system, improving muscle mass and, as I said, coordination. And is exercise an important part of socialisation? It's likely to be part important. So let's look a little bit at the data that we have. So the first paper I want to mention is a paper that was done in Sweden. And it looked at many factors, looking at risk factors for hip dysplasia and elbow disease in Labrador retrievers. And interestingly, they found there was an increased risk of these conditions when you were exercised by chasing sticks or chasing balls. And indeed, this seems to be a bit of a pattern, because another study looked at risk factors for osteochondritis in dogs and found an increased risk of playing with other dogs too. If we're looking at boxers, we find that dogs that are kept on slippy floors for the first 7 weeks of their life are 1.6 times as likely to develop clinical signs of hip dysplasia. Now, to me, these are all connected by the nature of the exercise. The quality of the exercise in each of these studies is dogs who might be approaching the physical limits of their and their joints' abilities. That boisterous, relatively uncontrolled exercise that might lead to sudden transient overloading or percussive damage to the joints. Now, a very interesting study was published fairly recently looking at a group of larger breed dogs in Norway and looking at husbandry factors and exercise factors that might be associated with hip dysplasia. And they found that puppies walking on stairs from birth to 3 months of age had an increased risk of developing hip dysplasia, which perhaps may be in keeping with our theory that dogs might be prone to overloading these joints. But very interestingly, they found a decreased risk of off-lead exercise from birth to 3 months of age. And indeed, birth during the spring and the summer and birth on a farm seemed to be protective. So this particular paper concluded that young puppies under 3 months shouldn't be allowed access to stairs, but they should be allowed outdoor exercise on soft ground in moderately rough terrain. And the nature of living in Norway is that if you're born in the spring and summer, you're likely to be outside in this time, whereas in the winter time, you're less likely to be outside. And it may just be that in these patients that are doing a little bit more exercise, they're actually getting better joint development, neuromuscular coordination, musculoskeletal development. We don't know, but certainly the evidence might suggest that sudden poor quality exercise of sudden loading and changing direction is bad, but actually a general increased level of moderate exercise might be beneficial. So when we look at mature dogs, in healthy adults, there was a study done about 20 years ago now, where they took dogs, they loaded them with 130% of their body weight, so for a 30 kilogram Labrador, that's about 40 kilograms, that's a lot. They ran them 5 days a week on a treadmill, 5 kilometres an hour for 75 minutes a day. They were compared to controls who were only kennelled, and after this period of time, the dogs that were doing this fairly extreme level of exercise had no ligament or meniscal injuries, no cartilage erosions, no osteophytes, no difference in cartilage health, molecular composition, thickness or mechanical properties of cartilage between these two groups. So this suggests that certainly in adult dogs, they're able to undertake a fairly significant amount of exercise. In adults with osteoarthritis, the picture is slightly different. In dogs that had osteoarthritis in the hind limbs, they showed that walking for a distance of about 1.2 kilometres resulted in significant more discomfort. Now, we have to think carefully about this, that while that short-term stiffness is certainly reflected on the outcome measures for this paper, we do know that in people, that there are long-term benefits of continued exercise in osteoarthritis that outweigh short-term stiffness. So again, saying that we should limit exercise in our osteoarthritic dogs is perhaps a little short-sighted, and perhaps we might be better to encourage a bit more. So, let's draw some conclusions. Firstly, when an owner comes in with a puppy, educate them on the difference between quantity and quality of exercise. It would seem wise to restrict them from extremes of exercise and boisterous play. We know husbandry seems to be important, and avoid stairs and slippy floors, like laminate floors or wooden floors, certainly for the first 2 months would make sense. But a moderate amount of controlled exercise may be beneficial. And one of the rules that's constantly come up against is people say, oh, the 5 minutes per month rule. As far as I know, there is no evidence for that, and indeed my feeling is that that is perhaps counterproductive, and these younger dogs should be doing more exercise than that, but in a controlled manner, rather than going down to the park and chasing around after each other. In adult dogs, there is little evidence for restriction, and certainly we know certain breeds of adult dogs can run for many, many hours a day without any great problem. In osteoarthritic dogs, yes, we might have an exacerbation of lameness in the short term, but there might be benefits in the long term to moderate exercise. So, let's look a bit more detail at our sporting injuries that dogs might get. There's two papers were published side by side, which gave us an awful lot of information. And what they did is they looked at about 1,500 dogs over a period of 6 months that were competing in agility training in competitions. And they found that nearly a third of these dogs suffered an injury. And even the authors came to the conclusion that they thought this may be an underestimation. So factors they found increasing the risk. If dogs had had a previous injury, they're 100 times more likely to get a subsequent injury. It didn't have to be the same site, but again, talking about the domino theory, are dogs changing their gait? Are they using their joints abnormally? So that's an important risk factor. If they're inexperienced, less than 4 years, they're more likely to suffer an injury. Being a border collie, I think perhaps anyone who knows or trains border collies, they will understand these are perhaps the most enthusiastic dogs, and sometimes we have to be careful not to overwork them. The two other factors that were important were use of alternative therapies and use of warm-up and cool-down. And we think these are possibly related to injuries the dog may have had that wasn't disclosed to the authors at the time. Now, factors that decreased the injury risk were dogs that had more than 4 years of experience in agility and, very importantly, handlers with more than 5 years of experience. So when we look in some detail about these injuries, and these were owner-assessed rather than veterinary-assessed, the most common site for injury was the shoulder. Now I would temper this a little bit and say the most common site is likely to be the forelimb. I think a lot of clients tend to recognise forelimb lameness as a shoulder gait abnormality, even if it's not actually the site of lameness. The most common injuries were those affecting muscle and tendon, and there were apparatus-specific injuries. So with the bar jumps, shoulder antebrachium, stifling carpus were most commonly affected, whereas A-frames, shoulder and digits, and the dog walk obstacles, ribs and head. So we advised our owners looking to train agility dogs, you should train your dog carefully and over many years. Don't rush into it. Seek advice from experienced handlers. The evidence clearly shows are either good at preventing the injury or spotting early injuries that they can prevent progressing into chronic lameness. Take great care with certain obstacles, and if the patient has an injury, even if it's subtle, seek veterinary advice early on to try and prevent that fulminating to becoming a more serious injury. We see injuries in other sports. Racing greyhounds, I think very commonly, we see fractures, particularly the subtibia, the acetabulum. We see a lot of joint problems, luxations of the interphalangeal joints. We see traumatic fractures, particularly in the tarsus and the carpus. But we also see muscle tears too, the long head of the triceps and the gracilis. If we group the working dogs together, things that we see commonly in bones would include humeral condylar fissures. We see Achilles tendinopathy, gastrocnemius muscular tendinopathy, which tends to manifest as changes at the fibrillary, and craniocruciate ligament disease. Muscle injuries such as iliopsoas myopathy, which I'll expand on later, and contracture of the infraspinatus. So, how can we prevent these muscle injuries? Well, the first thing to get over to the clients is that these working dogs, these racing dogs, you must consider them as athletes. Physiologically, these dogs are athletes. There's a wide variation in the athletic demand made on these dogs, and we need to understand the differences that each of these places on the dog. And when we look at our pet dogs, and it is still important, we still have even a sedentary whippet will in effect be a functional athlete, whereas in a pug we have to think very, very carefully about a pug's ability to exercise and what might happen if it suddenly undertakes a fairly extreme amount of exercise, such as going to the beach on a summer holiday, for example. The important thing is the muscle injuries are very painful, and actually they can be very difficult to treat because an area, a particularly severe muscle injury, will often form scar tissue, which reduces the ability of the muscle to extend and stretch, which might then cause other problems in that muscle or other joints. And as I say, we're likely to get gait alterations which might affect other joints and the spine, the way this patient walks. So again, prevention is always better than cure. So what can we do about this? Well, we can look at conditioning and training our dogs. Certainly, we know adequate conditioning may be important in preventing injury, and certainly inadequate conditioning might increase the risk of injury, but we can also overtrain our dogs too. We can induce injury as well. So our advice for growing dogs doesn't change, because if we look at young humans, particularly adolescents and high training, they tend to have increased risk of injury. And we think this is actually due to proprioceptive deficits. So the neuromuscular coordination leading to the fine control of the joint hasn't quite been developed. So you get focal overloading of these joints, and that leads to damage. We haven't got studies in dogs, but I think it would be pragmatic to take care with the young adult dogs, particularly large breed dogs, who might be very promising, might be very enthusiastic, but you have to just be careful to make sure these dogs are ready for the work that you're going to undertake. Again, strength training is something that's done more in the sledge dogs and the racing dogs. It's very discipline specific, and the idea is to exceed the work that's encountered, typically encountered in the discipline. This is the overload principle. But it's absolutely essential to have a high level of training in place first. So this should only be done in adult dogs, and again, you should seek advice from experienced trainers. Frequency of training is important. We know that if you don't train a dog for 8 weeks, we get a 41% loss of endurance. And it actually takes 8 weeks to get that fitness back. So if you get an injury that requires conservative treatment, it's going to take a long time to get that dog back into training. So explain to your clients that if the dog has a niggle, stop, sort the niggle out, and prevent this long, long layoff. We have sport-specific types of training. We know that agility course speed is improved if you spend longer time in training. Herding ability in sheepdogs is improved by practice. So we need to find an optimal level. Overtraining does increase the risk of injury. In racing dogs, the optimal training is 9.1% of their life, roughly 2.5 hours a day, which is very similar to human athletes. But remember, most racing dogs are sight hounds. They've been bred for 5,000 to 7,000 years to do this. They're very specific. And actually, that might be quite a high level for other breeds of dogs. In our racing dogs, regular orthopedic examination is so important to prevent this overtraining. Recovery periods are also important too. In agility dogs, serum lactate takes 4 hours to get back to normal, but in racing greyhounds, only 30 minutes. And as I said, sighthounds are unusual because they're some of the oldest breeds we have. They have very unique physiological adaptations. Now, endurance and proprioception. Endurance training, we need longer periods, 15 to 20 minutes minimum, to develop aerobic exercise strength. We get adaptation of our muscles, we get improved ligament and improved tendon strength. This may protect us against overuse injury, and certainly muscle development in people does seem to be protective against osteoarthritis. The evidence in dogs is fairly limited. Proprioceptive training, I think, is so important in canine health. And the idea is we get improved neuromuscular coordination, we reduce strains on tendons, we reduce strains on ligaments, and we reduce cartilage wear within the joint from this control. We think, certainly in people, that the age-related decline in athletic performance might be in part due to loss of proprioception. So we can work in proprioception with the simple physiotherapy techniques like Cavaletti rails, wobble boards, but we have to be doing this frequently and regularly, and at least daily would be beneficial. So, preparing for exercise. In people, warm-up is associated with reduced injury in people, particularly ligaments and tendons. And the idea is we're getting our body temperature up by around 1 degree centigrade. This improves blood flow to our muscles and to our connective tissue. In dogs, again, we haven't got the evidence for this, but I suspect, I would estimate, a 10-minute walk or jog on a lead might be adequate. Avoid excessive warms up, because again, this increases muscle lactate, can lead to fatigue and increase your injury risk. So your practice sessions should be at a lower intensity than competition level. And again, this is very important in agility and flyball, where dogs tend to get very excited and do things flat out. Muscle fatigue is associated with stress fractures. This is important, particularly in racing dogs, but also our working dogs in the humerus. We want to begin our exercise immediately after a warm-up, and stretching is potentially of some benefit. Now, recovery from exercise. Again, this is all based on taking work from humans. We haven't got a lot of specific evidence in dogs. So we're looking for a cool down after vigorous exercise. So a third to two-thirds of maximal effort. This is a gentle trot for most dogs for about 20 minutes. It may improve muscle recovery, but again, we haven't got great evidence for that. Stretching exercise, such as sit to stand, there are many others, might be particularly useful if there's a previous injury, but again, this is largely anecdotal. So, what do we tell our runners? Regular exercise is highly likely to be beneficial to musculoskeletal health. Walks of longer than 20 minutes, we need to build up endurance. If the client wants to take the dogs on very long walks, then building that exercise up when the dogs are younger in an early adult is important. We want to avoid the extremes of exercise. So if dogs do nothing all week and then they're expected to chase a ball for an hour at the weekend or chase a frisbee, I think you're asking for trouble with those joints. Or, as I said before, the classic for me, in a lot of presentations, the dogs don't do a huge amount of exercise, then they go their annual holiday to the beach and they spend 2 weeks maybe running around for 4 or 6 hours a day on that beach. And funnily enough, they tend to develop lameness afterwards. So again, build up to this or put limits on the amount of exercise there. Young dogs should be gradually introduced to this prolonged exercise. Working breed dogs in particular that have to do sudden changes may benefit from proprioceptive training. And consider a warm-up period if the exercise is going to be intense or prolonged, and that would be 20 minutes at a gentle trot on the lead. So next we want to talk about nutrition and weight control. Like exercise, we have to divide nutrition into quantity and quality. Quantity is how much of each dietary component is provided, and quality includes how these components are sourced and how they relate to each other. Now, weight control is important. As we all know, as vets and nurses, obesity is a problem in our pet dogs. And obesity is defined as a state in which the adipose tissue, the fat accumulation, can affect health. It's a very complicated disease, and it extends way beyond the increase in weight, which is so important. And it is poorly understood by many pet owners. So let's look at some evidence that we have pertaining to growing dogs. So again, going back to the Swedish paper that looked at factors in Labradors, they found that there was an increased risk of hip dysplasia and elbow dysplasia in dogs that were fed high dietary fat or a high proportion of energy derived from fat. Interestingly, they found that homemade foods, commercial diets, domestic food, i.e. plate food or treats, didn't seem to affect the incidence. We have a lot of studies done looking at calcium intake and calcium and phosphorus ratio, and it's certainly been associated with skeletal deformity and osteochondrosis, but the majority of these studies are in Great Danes, and Great Danes just aren't normal dogs. They're huge, they grow so quickly, and it's difficult to relate the significance of these findings to other dogs. There is, and we'll come back to this in a bit more detail, but a paper we published in 92 looked at the effect of limiting food consumption on hip dysplasia, and they found that dogs who had limited food intake had fewer signs of hip dysplasia, fewer clinical expression of the disease. The same group looked at factors that might be in there, so they looked at the dietary anion gap, so that's increasing the chlorine, decreased sodium and potassium, and they found that the reduced dietary anion gap led to reduced coxofemoral subluxation, again associated with hip laxity. But a study that was published by Mike Davis at Nottingham University last year came up with some very interesting findings. And they found that about 83% of commercial cat and dog foods were out with European guidelines for many factors such as copper content, selenium, arsenic content and calcium to phosphorus ratio. And what's important is a lot of these minerals kind of primary effects of calcium and phosphorus affecting growth, but a lot of the heavy metals in particular can influence and modify the uptake of other important compounds such as magnesium or iron, and it's quite possible that dogs with increased dietary intake early on in life are actually affecting the quality of the nutrition that they receive because of these imbalances in the food. So, the study I think most of us, or almost everyone knows about, was a study that the various papers published from, where they looked at 48 Labradors from 7 litters divided into 2 groups of 24. They fed one group normally. This was actually ad lib feeding, which I'm not sure is entirely normally. And the other group, which were actually matched pairs, were fed 25% less than their matched pair ate in the ad lib group. After 2 years, and both groups were fed the same, and they made some adjustments at 3 years to prevent obesity. The body condition score measured out of 9, in the normal group was 6.7, and in the diet-restricted group was 4.6, so a fairly significant difference, and the restricted group weighed an average a quarter less from a year onwards. But what was so important, so exciting from this study, was that at 2 years of age, 25% of dogs in the ad-lib fed group, the normal fed group, had evidence of radiographic evidence of hip osteoarthritis, and this compared to only one from the restricted group. And as you can see, as the time wore on, 8 years and 14 years, there was always a significant difference between the radiographic evidence of hip osteoarthritis in these dogs. But we also saw a reduced severity of elbow arthritis at 6 years, and again of shoulder osteoarthritis at 6 and 8 years. But importantly for me, the diet-restricted group lived nearly 2 years longer as well than the normally fed group. So, conclusions in growing dogs. The rate of feeding does appear to be important. Reducing the calorie intake of these dogs does appear to be important. We can't tell why that is. Does it affect the rate of growth? Is it to do with the body fat that's there? Is it an imbalance of calories? Or is there an imbalance of the minerals that are getting in, either from under or oversupply of certain elements? So, the pragmatic advice to the client is to feed a high-quality diet, to avoid diet body condition scores in excess of 5 over 9, and most Labrador puppies at around 9 to 12 months are in excess of this. I would also recommend you avoid giving supplements in any form, just because we don't really know what's in a lot of these. You might be providing an excess of dietary fat. Just be very careful about that. So, weight control in adult dogs. Certainly there's a long-standing correlation between obesity and osteoarthritis in humans. Increased weight causes altered joint loads. It might also alter joint alignments, leading to abnormal loads within these joints. It can be increased and abnormal. But mechanical stress alone doesn't explain this. So, for example, hand osteoarthritis, the hand doesn't bear any weight in people, and obesity are linked in people. Why should that be? So the seminal paper that was done on this was published in the late 90s, and this was a study looking at the effects of weight loss or change in weight with improvement in osteoarthritis symptoms. And they found actually there was a very poor correlation between improvement in osteoarthritis symptoms and weight loss, but the closest correlation was that with change in percentage body fat. So reduction in percentage body fat led to a fairly reliable improvement in symptoms associated with osteoarthritis. And people started asking questions, is there more to adipose tissue than just an energy store? Is there more to it than just carrying weight? And the answer is yes. White adipose tissue is a metabolically active endocrine organ. It releases many different inflammatory factors, and we know these as adipokines. And in obesity, we can get this pro-inflammatory state leading to an increase in these circulating adipokines, particularly the pro-inflammatory ones. We get adipokines in joint tissue, and in the stifle, for example, in dogs, the infrapatellar fat pads seem to be the main source. And we think in osteoarthritic joints, we get dysregulation of adipokines. So adipokines are important, they're present in joints of dogs, they're present in connective tissue. So, what can we do about it? Well, we often use accelerometers in investigating activity. And we know that dogs that are more active tend to have lower body condition scores. However, if you reduce a dog's weight, it doesn't necessarily seem to increase an activity of this patient. There's certainly a negative correlation between exercise and obesity. So, if for each hour of weekly activity, you reduce your probability or your chances of being obese. Makes a lot of sense. Certainly in people, there's strong evidence that weight loss can be achieved through diet restriction or through exercise, but when you combine them, the benefits are better. In dogs, we actually don't have a lot of good evidence of how to get weight off, mainly because it's quite difficult to control all the variables in a clinical setting, but certainly diet restriction and improving exercise, as in humans, is likely to be of use for us. So then, have we got some evidence that getting the weight off makes a difference? Well, yes, we do. weight reduction of 11 to 18% led to significant reduction in hind limb lameness. That was a study published in 2000. And Will Marsh at Glasgow published a study in 2010, again looking at large breed dogs with hip or elbow arthritis. And the owners found an improvement in lameness only with 6% weight loss. 6% is very, very small, particularly in these overweight Labradors. Looking at semi-objective outcomes, force plate analysis, and they found an improvement statistically with just under 9% weight loss. Again, we're talking at less than 3 kilograms in a 30 kilogram dog. This is not a dramatic change to get a statistically significant improvement in weight. So dogs that are coming in who perhaps might be uncomfortable, we can get an improvement with weight loss from them. In humans, we know there's a wide range of benefits in cardiovascular, muscular, metabolic health, and it's likely at least some of these benefits will be seen in our dogs as well. So we can recommend weight loss to our clients. So what to advise your clients? I find it's best if you explain the science of obesity, the understanding that it's not just weight, it's about effectively these adipokines and how they can be toxic to our joints. Explaining that to clients, and the vast majority of clients will understand these concepts and take them on board. And when you state that the body fat is effectively poisoning the joints, and explaining that by keeping the pet obese they may shorten its lifespan, then I think most clients are usually very, very compliant with weight loss. And I tend to have a picture of my own dog here, a Labrador, and say, this is what a Labrador body condition score 5 looks like. This is a healthy dog. And most people say, oh gosh, that's a thin dog. No, it's not. That's a healthy dog. So get a detailed history of what the pets eat. I advise them to measure the total daily food out once a day so everyone knows what the dog gets in the household, and that there's no overfeeding, and cut out the snacks. Get a detailed history of exercise and look at ways of modifying that. Set targets for an absolute final weight, but also targets of about half a percent body weight per week rate of weight loss. And as every vet and nurse knows, having a good trained weight counsellor in the practice can be absolutely wonderful in improving the health of our clients. Nutritional supplements. A nutritional supplement is any substance in the diet that provides health benefits. Common ones, glucosamine, chondroitin, and essential fatty acids. In healthy joints, there is no good evidence that any supplement can prevent osteoarthritis developing, and that's in any species. The vast majority of nutritional supplements are used in dogs with osteoarthritis, and I'm not going to go through this in great detail, I think it's covered well elsewhere, but it works through supposed modification of the disease process and treatment of the symptoms. And just as a conclusion, an overarching conclusion, despite a large volume of research in people, the evidence for efficacy in osteoarthritis is limited. So other factors that might be important, nutrient seems to increase the risk of cranial cruciate ligament disease, that may be multifactorial. The relationship with other conditions isn't entirely clear. What we do know is that early nutrient does seem to result in increased long bone length. The effects on the limb mechanics are not known, but certainly I would suggest delaying nutrient until after 6 months, as we tend to do in the UK anyway in working dogs. So a couple of slides lastly just on specific diseases. Osteochondrosis. Osteochondrosis is obviously a disease of cartilage in growing dogs. It typically manifests in growing dogs. And we see a transition approaching skeletal maturity from a perichondral to a subchondral blood supply. And it seems to be interrupted. So as a result, you get focal necrosis of cartilage in these areas. And the overlying cartilage can fissure, leading to osteochondrosis flaps. We see sclerosis of the subchondral bone. Nutritional factors, as I mentioned earlier, these are often thought to be overfeeding of energy, calcium and vitamin D3, but these are studies in Great Danes. So again, the advice would be to control the calcium phosphorus ratio, don't give calcium supplements, don't give vitamin D3 supplements, don't overfeed energy as we talked about, but the evidence to other breeds is questionable. Now, a lot of the exercise story seems to be based around this too. And we know in people that increased athletic activity is associated with a risk. In pigs, looking at macrotrauma, and this is quite horrible, where pigs were dropped from a height to induce marketed trauma. Certainly, that is a fairly extreme form of injury, but microtrauma in dogs has been suggested as a cause. The association with playing, as I've mentioned, has been suggested, but the evidence that we have is inconsistent. So, again, avoid the extremes of exercise in our growing dogs, but I don't think there's enough evidence to say that their exercise should be severely curtailed at a young age. The second condition that I want to mention briefly is ileocecal myopathy. Ileocecal myopathy is a condition I think we see a lot, and I think it's underdiagnosed because it can be quite challenging to diagnose if you're not looking for it. So the ileocecal is a combination of two muscles, psoas major, which comes from the lumbar spine, and iliacus, which comes from the ilial wing, and they combine and insert on the lesser trochanter of the femur. And it's the most commonly injured hind limb muscle, but I think it's often seen to secondary to hip or spinal problems. And again, as part of the domino effect, as I was talking about, if you've got, for whatever reason, hip dysplasia, your painful hip, and you decide instead of using your hip to pull the hip muscles, to pull your hip forward into flexion to increase your stride length, you start using the groin muscles more of the iliopsoas muscle, that might lead to injury. Or again, spinal problems, if the carriage of the hindquarters is abnormal, leading to increased use of the iliopsoas muscle, then we might end up with a myopathy. It's very common in working dogs, particularly the English Springer Spaniel, but also Border Collies. And I certainly see it most commonly in January and February in the working dogs. And my feeling is a lot of these dogs, whether actually working or just out for a walk, go out, undertake a lot of vigorous activity in the cold, then get put into kennels on the back of Land Rovers, driven back down off the hill, and so go from this vigorous exercise to actually get cold quite quickly. They don't have a cool down, and they end up damaging the muscle when they jump excitedly back at the back of the Land Rover or the car when they get home. So how do we make the diagnosis? Often, a very careful palpation, so before you manipulate any aspect of the joint, you're running your hands over the gluteals, down the thigh, and you run your hand into the groin, and you feel the insertion of the iliopsoas muscle in the lesser trochanter, and move your hand forward along the muscle. And you'll often find that there's a swelling, a heat, or a pain on direct pressure, and sometimes it can be marked that dogs will yelp on that. We also do an ileocecal test. An ileocecal test is sometimes quite difficult, particularly if it's second to hip dysplasia or hip pain. So the idea is when you do your hip extension test, just for looking at hip pain, you will hold the stifle and extend the hip back, and if the dog is painful, then that's positive for the hip joint. With the ileocecal test, if the muscle is very sore, you also get a reaction on that as well, so you need to interpret that hip extension test with direct pressure on the muscle. But if the hip test is negative, you then go back and repeat the hip extension, but before you extend the hip, you internally rotate the stifle. By doing so, you move the lesser trochanter caudally. So then when you go to extend the hip, you are stretching the iliopsoas much more. And you'll often find the dogs that are negative in hip extension then are consistently positive on this iliopsoas test. So again, it's a strong indication that this dog is uncomfortable. And I often will diagnose it clinically alone. If there's any equivocation, then I'll do an ultrasound scan. Ultrasound scan of the iliopsoas muscle is a reasonably skilled thing to do. I'm very fortunate that we have good imagers here at Willows, but it's something that if you have gross lesions, again, you should be able to spot with reference to the other side. So you'll have, on the ultrasound, you'll have increased volume of the muscle, and you'll have disruption to the normal structure of that muscle. Most of these can be treated conservatively. So very, very strict rest. I'll use an anti-inflammatory, and I'll use physiotherapy. I think a good physiotherapist is worth the weight in gold when managing this condition. But typically in colder weather, I'll ask the client to make sure the dog is completely comfortable, completely dry after exercise, and if they drive any distance back from the exercise, I ask them simply just to take the dog out for a short cool down period. It doesn't have to be long, 2 or 3 minutes of just gentle walking, just to get that muscle loosened up, stretched out, to prevent it happening again. Again, the problem with iliopsoas muscle tears is if you've got one area of scar tissue, then you effectively load or put more strain on the remaining parts of the muscle, and that can cause us issues further down the line. The last thing I want to mention is shoulder elbow syndrome. And the reason I bring this up, again, is the idea of the domino effect. It's getting an early diagnosis, early intervention to prevent subsequent structures becoming damaged. So when we're looking at four limb lameness, it's actually incredibly difficult to isolate the pain to the shoulder or the elbow. And you think, well, you do an elbow extension and the dog reacts, must be the elbow. You do a shoulder extension, the shoulder or the dog reacts, must be the shoulder. Well, the problem is we've got these two muscles, the biceps and the triceps, that span both the joints. So when you're doing the elbow extension, in effect, what you're doing is you're taking the biceps and you're moving it back. And yes, you might be putting pressures through the elbow joint, and if that's painful, that might get some reaction. But if the dog has a chronically painful biceps tendon of origin tendonitis, you may actually be doing putting pressure on that, and that might be what's causing discomfort. And similarly, if you do your shoulder extension, you may increase the tension and the long head of the triceps, which may load your elbow. So although you might get a positive response on extension of the shoulder, have we actually got problems with the elbow? So we have to be very, very careful about how we interpret these findings. So I think a common presentation is dogs that have pre-existing history of elbow dysplasia, been diagnosed previously, will often present with an acute deterioration. And, as you might expect, you'd extend the elbow and you get a reaction. But is this a source of acute deterioration? We often say, oh, it's an acute and chronic flare-up of elbow osteoarthritis. But could there be another problem? Have we actually got a biceps tendon of origin tendonitis that's causing the problem? So always check for shoulder disease in these dogs. Do a radiograph, but a good clinical exam is very, very important. So biceps tendon of origin tendonitis, put pressure in the tendon. Doesn't always have to be at flexion. Sometimes flexing the shoulder joint puts stresses on other muscles, other structures, which is difficult to interpret. Supraspinatus tendinopathy, again, it's a very common finding. It's often regarded as incidental. It can be transient, but if a dog's got mineralization of supraspinatus tendon, then it's likely had tendinopathy at some stage, even if it's not active. And also look for medial shoulder instability. Again, extend the shoulder, bring the shoulder up into abduction, and you shouldn't get more than around 30, 35 degrees, but certainly there should be no asymmetry with the other side. So these are all important things to look for when you've got an acute deterioration of a dog that has previous elbow disease, because if you're missing these shoulder diseases, then you may end up failing to treat the forelimb, and the dog may then load the other side and end up with elbow disease or shoulder pain on the other forelimb, and that becomes problematic. So we need to institute the appropriate therapy for a good outcome. So let's summarise. In growing dogs, weight control is important. We need a rapid response to any lameness that's present, and we need to make sure we get that treated correctly. In healthy adult dogs, we need to approach exercise as we would an athlete. So we need regular exercise, but we also need regular examination, particularly these dogs in training, and we need a rapid response to lameness. In adults with joint disease, the correct diagnosis and the correct treatment can prevent long-term problems. Chronic orthopaedic disease is rarely a single site. We often have the domino effect, whether there's a chronic disease in one joint and acute problems in other joints. We have to be very careful to pick up in all these different aspects to make sure that we keep the rest of the joints in this dog as healthy as we possibly can. So thank you very much for listening, and if there are any questions, we'll have a look and answer those. So I've got one question asking about the use of diets, specific diets. There's lots and lots of studies on diets looking at the use of JD, joint control diet. Most of the studies that have been done, they tend to show a statistically significant improvement in some factor, but a lot of them, firstly, are relatively mild effects. So although you get a statistical significant difference, what does it mean for each individual dog? It can be quite limited. And the second thing is, a lot of the studies themselves are not brilliantly well designed, in the sense that they make lots and lots and lots of comparisons and then report only the few that are significant. Of course, if you're doing lots of comparisons in a study, then you tend to find that at least some of them by chance will be positive. So I think we have to be very, very careful at looking at the data for that. And certainly in growing dogs, as I said before, there's no evidence particularly that supplements make a difference. I think I have had over the years several dogs that do tend to respond quite dramatically to essential fatty acids, either in the diet or a supplement, and again glucosamine and chondroitin. So I think what applies for a herd population as a whole may not be specific to individual dogs. So what I'd suggest that you do, or recommend to clients, is try, and in the absence of changing anything else, try them on a 6-week dietary control. Most studies show an improvement in this time. Try them on a 6-week dietary control or supplement control, and ask the client, you know, explain the science behind it, and ask them to be as objective as they can. And if the client's happy, the client feels there's a clinical improvement, if you feel there's a clinical improvement, then the dog should continue. But if after that time that you don't feel there's been any significant improvement, then I probably wouldn't recommend continuing the supplement.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kinley for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.